Robin, thank you so much for coming. I know it's the end of a long day, and we feel honored that you would take your time to be with us today. So we'll begin. Whiplash, How to Survive Our Faster Future is a book that's been called a postcard from the future. It sounds a warning about how the rapid technological change we're experiencing globally will result in a disrupted economy, creating the need to reimagine our skills and competencies in order to survive. Author Jeff Howe explains what's happening in Kentucky right now is, if we're lucky, 20 years ahead of what's going to happen elsewhere. Huge numbers of Americans, including those in booming coastal cities like Boston, are going to need help reimagining themselves. We all need to hope MIT learns as much as it can from Kentucky. Operating under a National Science Foundation CS for All grant, we are developing a pathway for computer science and computational thinking education with neighboring districts, Pikeville Independent Schools and Floyd County Schools in Kentucky. It's part of a larger vision, economic redevelopment for an economy disrupted by the collapse of coal and oil and gas industries. We will share the emerging initiative between East Kentucky business sector and public education as they work together to bring technology companies to Appalachia while developing the knowledge, skills, dispositions, and public imagination to address the future of work. My name is Eileen Owens. I'm an education consultant, previously director of technology and innovation at South Fayette School District in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. In my position at South Fayette, I worked with my team for over 10 years to create one of the nation's first vertically aligned K-12 CS STEAM pathways, building a pipeline for computer science within the school districts with a focus on professional development for teachers is my role in this grant. This is the final and third year of the grant, and I will be your moderator for today. So each of our team members lends their own unique contributions and perspective to this discussion. I'd like to take a few minutes to introduce them. Charles Rusty Justice is from Pikeville, Kentucky. Rusty's a graduate of MIT's Regional Entrepreneur Accelerator Program, REAP, and is the entrepreneur representative for the state of Kentucky. He's a co-founder of BitSource, a software development company retraining displaced coal miners to code, and a managing member of Jigsaw Enterprises, an applied engineering firm involved in heavy highway and transportation-related projects. He's a leader in regional economic development through SOAR, Shaping Our Appalachia Region, a regional nonpartisan nonprofit that champions local projects, programs, and advocacy, and also through Accelerate Kentucky, a nonprofit organization focused on unleashing the potential of Kentucky's innovators and entrepreneurs. Rusty's role in this project is one of public reimagination, connecting with school districts to develop an understanding of the entrepreneur experience in the future of work. Tracy Tackett, right here, is from Pikeville, Kentucky. Tracy has an extensive history as a public school teacher. She's director of digital literacy with BitSource and the education coordinator for Pikeville and Floyd County Schools through this NSF grant. Tracy is the regional lead for Remake Learning Days, which is centered in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. She's coordinating business, community, and education partners through this grant. Tracy's role is one of civic engagement. She works closely with teachers to ensure their success and connects education to the community. Petit Ruiz is from San Mateo, California. Petit is a research scientist with Digital Promise focused on the learning sciences, emerging technologies, and diversity, equity, and inclusion. In her work, she continues to develop and support research practitioner partnerships and to build inclusive computing pathways. Petit's role in this grant is focused on facilitating conversations around equity and inclusion through the implementation of student empathy interviews and examining research questions that help us understand how the pathways we're developing are inclusive and accessible for students in Eastern Kentucky. Our team also includes Principal Investigator Quinn Burke, Director of Computational Thinking Research, at Digital Promise, who's here today, and Emmy Iwatani, a co-PI, who is also a research scientist from Digital Promise. Our goal for today's panel is to address our process and the challenges we face in hopes that it will help you. And then we'll take the last 10 to 15 minutes to listen to your questions and brainstorm with you. So we hope this will be helpful to you. So to begin with, it's always important to understand how the project took shape, to learn about its early beginnings. And Rusty, it was your initial work that led to the development of this partnership. Tell us about your experience as co-founder at BidSource, your work with SOAR, and the discoveries you made that created the foundation for this project.
Okay. Hello, everyone. I'm Rusty Justice. I'm an unapologetic hillbilly. So from the heart of Central Appalachia, I live in a little town called Pikeville, Kentucky, 2 hours from interstate in any direction. Pikeville's a unique little place. Population just grew to 8,000, but we have a university with 2 medical schools, a business college, a regional hospital employs about 3,500 people, and the largest bank domiciled in the state. So it's heart of the energy region, and then the collapse of the coal economy and around 2012. I'm living proof that life is what happens while you make other plans. I'm a mining and civil engineer. My wife is a civil engineer, operated businesses, grew up there. My daughter's the 5th generation to be born in this little town. And so it's a really special place, deep in Tracy and my heart. It's been mislabeled in many ways and misunderstood. And so as a person, along with my business partner that operated businesses all my life since I got out of college, I watched all these really talented people that had worked in the mining industry, which is really very high-tech industry. We also have a very large oil and gas industry there. Lose their jobs and lose everything and have to leave the place they love because it was basically the only type of the economy that we had. And a mining and energy job had the earning potential of about 3 times the median income of all the other jobs. Healthcare is now a growing sector. We've really focused on it since 2012. But in our region, we had a bipartisan effort between a Democrat and a Republican, and we started an agency called SOAR, which is, and we built a blueprint of what do we need to do to change these dynamics, because our economy was totally disrupted. And if you came to Austin and turned off all of the tech companies in Austin today, you would understand what that would be like. I mean, our industry in 12 months, billions of dollars of capital investment and jobs, just infrastructure just evaporated. And so we built this blueprint, and I always say Central Appalachia, Eastern Kentucky has an advantage over other rural areas in that we might not know all the solutions, but we have identified all the problems and we agree collectively and in a bipartisan manner what they are, and we call that our blueprint. And so we started looking for jobs you can do in a geographically bound area, and we came across tech jobs. You can do them remotely, but we didn't have an infrastructure. We didn't have broadband. So it's very expensive to build broadband in the mountains of Appalachia. It's expensive to build anything there just due to the topography. And so we learned that these tech jobs were available. And so we decided to start a tech company. We were fortunate, we could self-fund. And so we put out an advertisement for people that had been displaced by mining, and we were gonna try to find 10, you know, we were gonna offer 10 jobs, and we had 950 applications in a week. So that just spoke to the scale of the problem at that time. And what we quickly figured out is we didn't know anything. We didn't know what we were doing. We knew no one in tech. we were coal people. Now we knew everyone in the supply chain of in energy. We knew the transportation people, the people on the mineral, the people that consumed the energy. We knew all those, the people that produced it, the labor force. You know, all those, we knew everyone, but we knew no one in tech. So we lacked that social capital that was necessary. And that's how I eventually ended up knowing Eileen and Petit. And so we just started on this journey. I always say a hillbilly coal miner is the equivalent of the Jamaican bobsled team. It got a lot of attention, and we leveraged that to just meet people. And we traveled, and through that, we met a lot of really good people that helped us gain perspective and point in the right direction. And these developers have, you know, most of them stayed the course, and we've gone from simple web and apps to, you know, working in machine learning, data science, and tinkering in the blockchain. So we're trying to start a tech sector there. We've worked concurrently to build an infrastructure where we located BitSource. We bought the building where BitSource is. It's an old Coca-Cola bottling plant. And we bought it because the fiber optic cable that went to the university and the hospital was on the poles in front of it. So we just located, just like in the desert, you know, all the animals will congregate around the water. We congregated around the only pipeline to the external markets. We're working now for companies around the country and doing work in Central Appalachia. And each year we grow our capabilities and our network. And so, anyway, that's the backstory and how we got to where we are. As a result of that, I met a person. My daughter was in a university in Western Kentucky, and a fella calls me out of the blue, and I thought that he identified himself as being from Western Kentucky. I thought it was something to do with my daughter, and I took his call. And anyway, it wasn't. It was a fella from Kentucky, but at MIT, and we ended up, he invites me out to Western Kentucky because in rural Western Kentucky, they're having the same kind of problems. These are really rural problems, and disruption through technology is coming to all of us. And so we do a kind of a voyage of discovery in Western Kentucky, and I invite him back to Eastern Kentucky to do the same thing, and we start inviting people, and we get a church bus, and we spend 3 days driving around Appalachia. I'd met Eileen, she'd cold call me. And she'd read an article, she cold called me, and so we ended up inviting her. She invited us up to see her school. It's amazing. We saw we needed that there. And Tracy I'd known through other educational efforts. She was a phenomenal teacher in our region and had very highly acclaimed. And so we get the teachers, we get as I go down the road, didn't know what we were doing, but we got people from all the stakeholder groups. So we had private sector people, we had government people, we had educators, and we just got in this van and we drove around for 3 days, had some folks from MIT, some folks from Carnegie Mellon, and we just drove around and looked and thought, what's possible? And from that, so many things from that 3 days, including us sitting here talking to you today and this large-scale grant that we've done in schools, because what we learned is digital literacy was really low in our part of the world. So an example of that is a few years ago, before COVID, because COVID's really accelerated digital literacy on its own. Before COVID, we offered a free website to small businesses we identified that had annual sales greater than $300,000 a year. And we offered 100 businesses a free website, had zero takers. That speaks to digital literacy in our region. And so we started down a path of digital literacy. Our school teachers didn't know much about it. Our business community, small business community didn't know much about it. And so that led to there. So it's a long-winded story, and I apologize.
Well, yeah, and a really interesting aspect of that is you knew that you had to teach skills to the coal miners to be tech.
Yes.
And then I know that in education, we have to teach skills and dispositions to help the students gain knowledge. So the question is, what about the dispositions that you have to generate for the future of work with the coal
miners? Well, you know, the skills transfer is something we can do. There's lots of resources and lots of different ways and methodologies for transferring the skills. But to take people mid-career, our youngest developer was 35, our oldest one was 52 of those 10 people we hired. And to get them to believe that they could do it was a bigger challenge than the skills transfer in the early stages. And so we actually offered 11 jobs, and we offered one to a young man. He was probably 40 years old and had two children, had been making $100,000 plus a year in the mining industry. He'd lost his house, he'd lost his car, he was living in a mobile home and working for minimum wage. And we offered him, and we offered him a job starting out at $15 an hour, which, you know, was okay. Everyone we hired was on unemployment. But we offered him this job as well because his story was just so compelling, we just couldn't say no. And on Monday, when everybody reported for their first day, only 10 showed up, and he didn't. And so I called him. I said, you know, we were supposed to start today. And he said, man, I'm just a dumb old coal miner. I can't do that. And so that spoke, and immediately we pivoted, and we said, we've got to do more than just train people. That's where really the reimagination training concept came from, is we have to talk to them, not just about what they were learning, but how to think about what they were thinking about. And that was probably as important as any of the skills transfer that we did.
That's such a good point. And so in order to make this project happen, we knew that they were working on the economic redevelopment, but education needed to be a part of it. And so we invited them to South Fayette, and they came in and looked at our model. And just to frame what the model is that we're talking about, we have created computational thinking as the new literacy. Just like kids learn math, reading, science, social study, they also have a CS course. And they also, at grades K through 8, they have at least one or two STEAM teachers in their building, and they constantly go through this as they would another. And then the lessons are vertically aligned, so they're gradually more complex and interrelated. And you know, kids at very young levels are learning to program with block-based code, and they're learning to program motors and sensors and run robotics and do challenges and eventually make apps and design for social good. And so the pivotal piece in this model happens at eighth grade, because K through 8, we can really give students the lessons and the curriculum they need. It can be mandatory, but after that, when they hit high school, they have to select their courses. So we, in order to build that pathway 9, 12 and make it strong, we put an eighth grade Python course in. So it's mandatory again. Every student has eighth grade Python. That tripled the number of students that we now have in the 9 through 12 program. So in the pathway for 9-12, you can choose Python 1, Python 2, Honors 3 Python. You can choose APCS Principles, APCSA Java, Data Science, Cybersecurity, and then Creative Computing with using Arduinos and Raspberry Pi or anything else you like. But it's that progression that really is the model we're talking about. So Tracy, you've been working closely with the two school districts in Kentucky to help them create their vision. A lot of people wonder, how do you start vision casting? How do you start the process to actually move a school district forward?
Well, we found that with our teachers, we had some of that same changing the narrative, because teachers want to know what they're teaching and they want to be experts. But we found that, you know, our teachers had not had these computer science courses, and they didn't really know how to teach computer science and didn't even know what computational thinking was. And so we just started with small efforts, very small things that we could plug in places that you might not think, like a library, or there might be a school that had a computer lab, but they were teaching touch typing, but it was a very natural fit. And so after I went on this church bus drive around Eastern Kentucky, not even knowing why I was there with these folks from MIT, if you can imagine, and Carnegie Mellon, and I met Eileen, and She invited me up to see South Fayette in action, and I thought, oh my goodness, here I've retired from teaching, and I've missed all of this. I've missed my own children getting this type of education. It still makes me emotional, but I was grieved, and I came back home, and I thought, you know, I can talk to my friends. I'd taught in Floyd County Schools. I'd taught at Pikeville Independent, and this was prior to us even getting this grant, before we even had these formal relationships really together. And I said, you know, some of the things I saw, and I'd taken pictures and I was giving them to my teacher friends, and they were doing just one little thing here or there in these two districts. And I said, you know, there's some mini grants for $1,000 through a local education cooperative. I know you're busy. How about if I write that for you? And I'd, you know, written them before when I was in the classroom. And they were awarded, so then they had $1,000 to buy some materials. And so that was pretty low stress. You know, they really didn't have an administrator forcing it on them. It was just what we call a little bet, based on Peter Sims' book, Little Bets. You just bite off one little thing, try it. If it works, great. Continue. If it doesn't, pivot, fail fast, fail forward. And so we started very small like that in these two districts, with just people either in the library or in a one particular content area class, or even a computer lab. And then we started, you know, getting attention from people outside of these districts wanting to know how we were doing it. Eileen had spoken to some people who thought it was remarkable, and we're thinking, this isn't remarkable. We don't have a pathway. We're just trying some things. But as a result of that, it was enough that the National Science Foundation felt like we should, you know, be awarded this grant, and then we were able to start building that out K through 8 with more intention. We used professional development, which we'll talk about more. And we're just really pleased with, over these 3 years, what we've gradually been able to build out. And a lot of it has been changing that mindset of teachers. And one teacher finds success and then shares it with their colleague, and it's grown.
So it's really amazing to think that we didn't know where we were going. That's an important, we knew where we wanted to go, but we were in the beginning just trying little bets, so to speak, right? And then luckily, by building that out and having data and experiences that prove we are moving forward, we were able to secure the National Science Foundation grant to really solidify this. And Pati, as a researcher, can you tell us about the grant, how it's structured, the research questions you're investigating, and some of the outcomes we've achieved so far?
Yes. So the grant itself is meant to begin developing these pathways that we've been talking about in computer science and computational thinking. And so a little bit of that is the professional development that Tracy will talk about a little bit later, and using Eileen's South Fayette model. Another piece of that has been working with teachers and administrators at each of the two districts in order to develop the pathways themselves. And the pathways are just like identifying what's happening at each grade level so that we're sure that students are being exposed to computational thinking and computer science from K through 8. So that, as Eileen said, once they get to that 8th grade, they can take the Python and feel comfortable and confident taking that course. And then also, if they're interested, taking computer science at the high school level as well. And so we focused on a few questions, three specifically. One was around professional development. Another one was around the curriculum itself. And the question is, what does it take to create an integrated K-8 computing pathway in this Eastern Kentucky coal mining community? And one of the things that we've found is that it was important to shift mindsets like Rusty was saying earlier, and to help teachers see themselves being able to teach this curriculum so that they could also help their students see themselves participating in computing. And so that's been one of the big things that I'll talk about a little bit later too. The second research question focuses on the competencies themselves, and we're trying to understand what specific competencies, computing competencies, each of the districts would identify as important for their communities, because we know that it's important for there to be district buy-in and for the competencies that are identified, like algorithmic thinking or data or modeling, to be something that the district and that the teachers at that district feel are important for their students to understand. And so we were lucky in that when we started this grant, the Kentucky Academic Standards for Technology were unveiled right at the same time. And so the districts ended up mapping their curriculum to those standards for technology. So there was something for us to work with, and the districts themselves were seeing it from the state of Kentucky as well as a priority. And something that we're really proud of as a group is that even though COVID hit right as this grant was getting started, we really haven't been affected or set back by COVID, because as Tracy will talk about a little bit later, we were able to move our professional development online with the support of South Fayette and the instructors at South Fayette. We delivered online professional developments, and so we're still on track. Tracy and I have been working with teachers. We'll talk about that a little bit later as well, but we're still on track, and we've seen a lot of good progress.
Now that sounds exciting. I know that we talk a lot about how important professional development is. Tracy, can you talk about it, the critical factor to success in this initiative? Can you tell us about the Summer Institutes, the perspectives of the teachers, successes and challenges, what changes we had to make moving into the Institute, and really the way the Institute started in the beginning, the focus, and now at the very last year, how the focus has switched? What kind of professional development do we now need to do?
In 2019, when we first received the grant, we thought we would start with some small book studies, and each of the districts identified teacher leaders to be part of their STEAM team. And we did the book study of Little Bits so that the teachers were aware of that concept of not thinking you have to have this figured out before you even start. And we were able to meet in person and do those book studies. And then we also did small in-person professional developments on what is computational thinking. And so we had that foundation laid when COVID happened. And that was about the time we were moving into that first summer of 2020, what we call the Summer Institute, where teachers were going to be coming together in person and learning these hands-on lessons. Many of them could be unplugged. You know, you didn't have to have technology devices, because we didn't have a lot of those at that point. We were very early in implementation, and we didn't have the Sphero kits and the Dash and Dot robots and all of those things that you typically think are needed to teach computer science to primary students. But in that first year, we had to pivot and teach those courses online. So through the use of Google Classroom and Zoom, we had teachers joining these classes from home. Some of them were at school, but they had their own children participating in the activities and lessons with them, which a lot of them enjoyed. And the teachers were just introduced to what these types of lessons would look like and how they might implement them into their regular core content classes. So it could be a math class. They were learning about how to use these different tools, but mainly why it was important for them to focus on the competency. What do we want students to learn? That was the most important thing, even more so than learning how to use a certain tool. And then last year, in year two, we wanted to really focus on teachers implementing a lesson and getting them to, you know, in that first year, they learned some things, but then they were teaching virtually, and it was really hard to teach hands-on classes through their virtual sessions. So they really worked on implementing with their students this school year, creating a lesson, implementing it, and then recording that. The districts have worked collaboratively to create a lesson capture tool, which is a database of all these lessons that the teachers have developed. And it's really neat because you rarely ever see two districts working collaboratively on something like this. They're so competitive. I've worked in both of these districts. I got to hear, you know, how they feel about each other. But to see this work that they're doing is very unusual. And so these teachers are putting those lessons into the database, and we're growing that. And this summer, we're really focused on sustainability. How are we going to keep these teachers moving forward after the grant ends? And so we have a lot of ideas for that. The Summer Institute is going to be in person. And last year, another thing that we implemented was a workforce piece. And we invited Rusty to speak, Peyton, his COO, who is the most creative person we know, and he's very connected with entrepreneurs who are doing online businesses, all different types of e-commerce, and he introduced teachers to that. And we found that teachers don't really know what students need beyond their grade level, even, you know, like when they graduate, what do they need to be prepared for? And we're preparing them for ACT testing, or we're preparing them for, you know, to be successful in a college course, but not always giving them the skills they need for workforce. And so one of the things the teachers heard repeatedly was that kids needed more competency in soft skills. They needed to be punctual, and they needed to have public speaking opportunities. And so the teachers came away really excited about what they did, and we want to implement more of that this summer by having lots of different speakers from workforce talk to the teachers and start breaking down those silos so that there's more conversations between these different groups.
Yeah, so that's a really good point. And Rusty, you know, we've talked about connecting business and education. We talked about how our teachers were kind of in a silo and business was. And then you came to the Institute and started opening up and helping them reimagine what the future of work looks like and what their role is and how they can help it. So can you elaborate a little bit?
Okay. One of the things I've had the opportunity to do is to participate in a program at the MIT Sloan School called the Regional Entrepreneurship Accelerator Program, and where I got to be the entrepreneur representative for the state. And Kentucky was the first domestic team to participate in this program. And we learned about the stakeholder model. Venture capitalist, government, which we call agency, because we have about as many nonprofits as we do we have government agencies, so we call it agency in Kentucky. But corporations, entrepreneurs, and academics, and so it's a very siloed. Everyone's working. Say you're working on entrepreneurship or education, no one talks to each other. And so there's a lot of duplicative efforts. There's a lot of people. I always say for people, non-entrepreneurs, to be teaching entrepreneurship doesn't make sense to me because entrepreneurship's very definition is a person who's at risk with their own capital. And so if you're not that, then you're not really an entrepreneur. So it'd be like me, who's not a very musical person, teaching music. I appreciate music. I like it. But you wouldn't want me teaching you that. And all of our academics teach entrepreneurship, and that's a big thing. And so you want to get that mix. And so for the teachers to hear, who are all doing entrepreneurship programs there, and technology is a part of everything. You know, it's just a fundamental. It's like, you know, reading and writing arithmetic, as we used to say. And you know, now technology is just that other core basic skill. And So how to take an entrepreneurial approach to this. And so by participating, breaking down these silos, we get real entrepreneurs in the room with the educators and inform them, you know, here's the flaws in your logic, here's how to maybe to think about it. Because in academics, we tend to want to get things perfect and then move. Whereas in entrepreneurship, you get it going, then you get it right. You just get something moving, make something happen, and then work to improve it. And failure is okay. It's okay to fail as long as you're learning and you're pivoting. And so so that's very counterintuitive to people in agency or in even in corporations. Corporations do not like to fail. And so they're very risk adverse. And so entrepreneurs will take risk. But entrepreneurs are also unruly and they're hard to deal with and all those things. And so as my partners will tell you, I drive them crazy. But anyway, so what you have to do is you have to get that blend down in the mix. And so the learning and understanding the stakeholder approach. And then two other things, the lemonade from the lemons of COVID is it accelerated digital literacy in our part of the world anyway. We've just seen that whereas people, fears, false evidence appearing real. People were afraid of the technology, the teachers, the small business community, all of them, and they were forced to learn how to navigate and do that. And so that if there was a positive that came out of COVID, it was that. And so I don't know what point I'm making.
It's perfect. Okay. I know your point. You're good.
All right.
Basically, Rusty is explaining that there are many facets of this, and it's the getting the first, we are working with teachers to help the teachers understand how to teach in this new way and the mindsets that are needed to be an entrepreneur in the business and all the dispositions that need to be brought forward in teaching if you are in education. And then the other aspect is you talked about connecting the businesses with education, but another piece is communities. How do we bring the community and create deeper relationships with families? That's part of the reimagination piece. So Tracy, can you tell us the work you're doing with the community, with families, to help with reimagination?
Not long after we started this project with this grant, I was approached by Remake Learning Days out of Pittsburgh. And we have been partnering with Remake Learning Days since 2019 now to host family-friendly events in schools, businesses, and community organizations all around our region. And so Eastern Kentucky is one of 17 of these regions. Some are in Pittsburgh. There's a Remake Learning Days in Florida and California. And we're just really excited to be part of this work because schools are opening up their doors and inviting families to come in so they can see the technology their students are learning. The businesses are creating opportunities for kids and families to see other job opportunities because a lot of times you only see the careers of your parents. And so when BitSource opens up their doors and allows families to come in, they can sit down with these developers and ask questions about how to find code or they learn about the different projects they're working on from 3D design. They designed a three-dimensional model of a tunnel that was going to go under a road in our town over to the hospital because it was so congested with nurses and everyone walking across the road. And then they created a scale model of that, and then they actually built it, and it's amazing. But kids are able to come in and see the work that they do. They're learning about 3D printing and CNC machines on a huge scale. And there are many tech businesses that are opening up their doors, or kids are coming in and seeing the lack of technology but the need for it. So we have a local quilt shop owner who is happy to teach kids to sew, but she struggles to do anything online. She can't sell online. She doesn't know how to operate her own website. And so she's able to find students through this opportunity who are, you know, wanting to partner with her to help her with her technology. So Remake Learning Days has been a great way for us to build these partnerships. Oftentimes businesses don't see how they can connect with education, or community organizations like soil conservation districts or extension offices. And so we have seen just a remarkable receptiveness by all of these different stakeholders. And it's just really, it's a festival in the spring, 10 days of just focusing on family engagement all around our region.
I think you have, what, 70?
We have over 70 events registered for this year's festival that will happen in April.
Yeah, it's pretty significant. Mm-hmm. Petit, we'll soon be at the end of our three-year grant. What activities are in place to sustain the pathway, and what signs do you see that this pathway can sustain itself?
So we're really focusing on the culturally relevant pieces of this curriculum and the pathway itself, and really putting teachers and students and the community at the center of the pathway. Tracy and I recently have worked with 7 teachers at both districts to help them conduct student empathy interviews, where each teacher interviewed several students, most of them interviewed 5 students, and we had students at each grade level interviewed so that we could better understand the needs of the students themselves, how they saw themselves represented in computing, what types of lessons they wanted to be getting more of, less of. And we learned things from both the students' responses, but also the teachers. The teachers enjoyed hearing from their students, interviewing them in a formal way to better understand how their experiences as teachers are similar or different from the students that they're teaching and working with, and how the students wanted to see the lessons or see more technology and computing integrated into the curriculum. So the next stage of this work, we're hoping to bring in the role of community, the role of kinship, that we've learned kinship as a term from our colleagues in Eastern Kentucky, and culturally responsive approaches to the content and the development of the pathways, so that we can start to measure the impact of the pathway also, and really focus on its impact on students and the wider community in Eastern Kentucky.
That's great. And I think the important thing throughout this whole process has been that even though there was a model started at South Fayette that looked a certain way, you know, its own pull-out, you know, kind of curriculum, this is very different. This is every teacher designing within their curriculum and then making sure that that permeates all curriculum areas. So you can see the models change and they adjust, because that's the beauty of designing one that works for your own being culturally relevant and working for your own community. We right now, we're so happy that you've been here, that you took your time to talk with us. What we want to do now is take time for questions, to have a discussion. If there's anything that we didn't hit on that you need to learn more about, please feel free to ask us.
Yes.
Great content. But I'm a visual thinker, so as you were explaining the pathway, what is it? Like, is it a series of curriculum? Is it an online library? I'm just trying to visualize what is the pathway.
So imagine a spreadsheet, and you have each grade level in one column, and then you have different competencies identified by the districts themselves in another column. And then you have specific lessons or activities that teachers at that grade level are going to be filling in for each of those competencies, so that any teacher at the district can take a look at that document and say, okay, I'm a third grade teacher. I want to bring this into my classroom. These are some options for me. But then, like Tracy said, teachers might take lessons that they see in the repository for another content area and modify that lesson, because it's integrating computational thinking in a specific way that they're interested in, and bring it into a different grade level or a different content area. So the competency map itself, I see as a spreadsheet with a lot of information, a lot of vocabulary. Again, each of the competency maps is unique depending on the district. So the district leaders and teacher leaders that are developing the document identify what things they want included, and then they fill out that document so that it makes sense to them.
Mm-hmm. And those competencies are based on the state standards, so that they are not missing and having gaps. And then when they look at this map, they can see where they have holes or where they're not being equitable in a certain grade level or a certain content area. And so some lessons, when Eileen would first tell me about this and what I got to see when I went to South Fayette, there is a Play-Doh kit called Squishy Circuits. And teachers can use that with kindergarten students when they read The Very Hungry Caterpillar, which happens in every kindergarten class. And they build a little caterpillar using that circuit, and they learn about electricity, and they make a science connection. And then in first grade, one of our teachers took a Code and Go mouse. It's like just a little push-button mouse, go forward three blocks and turn right. And they were learning about nouns, and they created a noun town. So in their art class, they created a little model of a town with houses and roads, and then the first graders coded that mouse. Like I may tell Patti to go to the church or go to the grocery, and then they code the mouse, and they had labeled all of the nouns on the map, and they called it Noun Town. And so, you know, they try to make sure that things like that are happening at each grade level. It may be happening in a core content class, or it may be a collective lesson where they're doing part of it in their STEM class, part of it in their art class, and learning part of it in their content class, like the Noun Town activity. Three teachers worked together on that. So that is kind of what this pathway looks like, but then the lesson capture tool would be more in-depth and have a full lesson plan rather than just a little snippet of an idea.
What we tried to really, for me, what my goal was, you know, begin with the end in mind. So, you know, you're forming a person that eventually people like me will employ. So what do we want these people to be able to do? We want to be problem solvers. We want to have good character. You know, we want these certain things rather than just, you know, the proper way to, you know, structure a sentence. So just like that, when you're teaching, think about not just passing that test. Think about what kind of human you're creating there that can have all these skills. Just like when they're teaching three different things in Noun Town, they're also teaching these other things. Now think about that, be intentional about that, just as you are these three things you're focused on in Noun Town. And always try to be doing those things, and then to bring awareness to the teachers of what the needs of the current marketplace were, because even at our university, we've restructured their computer science curriculum because it was dated. And so, you know, like I say, educators tend to want to be experts, and so if they're not current, then it's not, it's not gonna happen. So this is where technology is going. So the same lessons that was passed on to us by people from MIT and Carnegie Mellon, this is where you need to be. Not, you know, you need to be thinking about data science and machine learning, not how to build an app, you know. And that's how you need to grow to, you know, you build an app on your way, just like our friend over here said, his family circus analogy really struck home with me. His map is is you need to know these things, and you're creating your workforce, and they have to work up progressively to these levels, but that you know where the end in mind is. What is it you're trying to get to? And so, and by then having that presence in the community where we say, now come down here and look at it and see what it looks like, because that was not present in our part of the world. And so, you know, so people can come and see firsthand, students, educators, parents, other businesses. So we have business events. We have all, anyone in the community that wants to learn about tech and the things it can do for you and how you participate in global markets and how do you drive business in rural areas or any area, these are the tools. And so just to make those visible and not abstractions is what we've tried to do.
Can you talk a little bit about the support system or structures that were put in place to support these teachers and what sounds a lot like project-based learning? Because what we see a lot is, especially as we approach middle school, that those teachers become very siloed in their content area of expertise. So how did you get them to collaborate across content areas to help drive home this 360 approach to implementing?
Well, one of the things that we found, one of our districts is larger, 6,000 students, versus Pottville Independent that's smaller, 1,200 students. They only have two schools. One is a K-6 and then a 7-12. And that collaboration came much easier in that small district where teachers, you know, they work with each other every day, they're having lunch together. They can talk on bus duty versus the larger district where they don't have that common planning time maybe, and you know, it's just, it has to be much more intentional for them to pull that off. So we're definitely still working to create that. That's part of that sustainability piece that we're really going to be working on this summer in the Summer Institute, how to not make this fall on one teacher, that it's all up to me, and if I can't do it, then it's not going to happen. But, you know, if the art teacher is making the noun town, the language arts teacher is teaching about nouns and they're labeling it, and then the computer STEM teacher lets them code the mouse, then that's not too much for any one person. And it's so much more beneficial when they are learning these cross-curricular things together. I just left a session a while ago where they were talking about that very thing. But getting back to your question about the standards, our standards are well written, but one of the things we're trying to really focus on is adding that problem-based learning or project-based learning approach that connects to the real world and workforce. So an example of that, one of our after-school groups worked with a local donut shop, and they found out that they needed cutters for alphabet letters for the donuts because people want to spell their names for birthdays and things. But he couldn't find any cutters that when the dough wrote would rise, it didn't distort what the letter looked like. And so he tasked this group of kids to create these cutters. And they were so excited about that because it was real world. They were working for a real business. They couldn't wait to see what the product, you know, looked like if it worked. And so they were persistent. When it didn't work correctly, they tried it again and tried it again. And then the students asked the question, will these be food grade safe? Because our extruder on our 3D printer, They researched it and found out that was lead. And so then they decided it was not a good idea for them to give these to him to actually use. But that's just an example of how we, by breaking down those silos and finding out who in our community, a lot of that happens through Remake Learning Days, we find out who our community members are who are willing to invite kids in and participate in educational initiatives. And then, can you give me a problem? Well, our quilt shop has a problem. She needs help with learning technology skills. We can connect kids to her. But that is something that the standards obviously don't give us. But we do know that kids need to think algorithmically. We know they need to be working with data. We know these things, and the standards are well aligned with national standards. But we it's up to us to find these connections. And so that's why in the Summer Institute, we're really focused and really determined to help teachers meet more and more and more of these community people who can come alongside them. That's how Rusty and I became colleagues now, is because when I taught gifted education, and I certainly was not gifted in everything and didn't know engineering, but I was teaching engineering projects with my students, I reached out to him to come and help me. And being the educator he is at heart, he was willing to do that. And so that's kind of how our path has gone and what we want to steer more teachers down.
I will say one other thing that I've noticed in terms of supporting teachers is I've been really impressed with the project because it is a research practice partnership, and we do have Tracy, who is deeply embedded in both of these communities. As she mentioned earlier, she taught in both districts, and so she has deep connections to the people who are in these communities. And so because of Tracy, earlier I mentioned that COVID didn't really put a stop to our work, and that is really, I think, a testament to Tracy and the role that Tracy has in the community and the way she's able to engage and bring teachers in and bring others along. And so the teachers that we've been working with have formed a great community, and they support one another, and we're hoping that they'll be the ones to bring others along with mm-hmm. them. So that's one of the things we also want to continue exploring, that culture piece, the kinship piece, and the goal of helping the community itself.
It was interesting because when I was a newly retired teacher and everybody would say, no, what do you do? What are you doing now that you're retired? I'm like, it's just me. I'm just here showing you. I just went up here and saw this school and I want you to know what I learned. So some of those teachers just, you know, kind of were willing to step out and try something different. But we noticed in Pipeville Independent, we had teachers who were coming on board from the middle and pushing it up to their administrators, like, we want this. They were advocating for it. These teachers were going to the PTA group or PTO and saying, look what our kids made, and letting them talk about it and getting parents supporting and then pushing it up to the administrators. In the other district, it was more of a top-down. The administrator in one school was super excited, and she went up to South Fayette and saw it herself. And then she started pushing it down to her teachers, and then from there it grew out through the rest of the district. So it looked different in both places. There was interest from different, you know, areas, different groups.
So one of the things we did, because, you know, I'd seen Eileen's school, and, mm-hmm. and I told Tracy about it. And so we said, you know, there's one of the books we read a lot of books when we were starting BitSource, and I'll mispronounce it, but there's a Japanese term, Jiatsu Genbutsu or something, but it's go and see for yourself. That's what it means. And so we raised some private funds to pay for how many, 40 people to go? So we just got in the community. I just went and told people, listen, I've seen something that's really spectacular. We need it here. It's part of this whole thing, because through our SOAR initiative, we're working systemically. It's a systemic approach to these, you know, these problems that we just keep having. And so I said, this is part of what we need. And so we raised enough money to send 40 people to Pittsburgh for a few days. And so we got enough apostles that had seen it themselves, that then would confirm that we just weren't some crazy people, you know, running around this, you know, saying the sky's falling. And so just building that momentum, because if you have, you know, the truth, if you can just get people to go see it, then you can say, okay, it makes it much easier to sell. And that's an entrepreneurial approach. You know, that's...
And those people were self-selected. We threw out the opportunity. Who would want to go up and do Summer Institute in South Fayette, back before we even had
the strangest group, it wouldn't be the people you'd expect. You know, the people you'd think would be thought leaders, they're not. And you know, the thought leaders are everywhere, and you just have to give them opportunity. So if you create opportunity, the doers will go. The people that are passionate, that's who you want on your side, are the people with passion.
But Dee, may I ask, do you, because of the, it's grant funded, right, at NSF, do you have an opportunity to do a little longer term look at, like, where these students end up, how the teachers embrace it? Like, there's a lot of fascinating kind of trajectories you're on. And sometimes there's frustration with grant funded efforts is that when it stops, you can't keep collecting and keep watching and keep talking and, you know, researching.
That's the great thing about where we are. The relationships and the kinship, it's like we claim kin, we become family, like we're all family. Our relationships with these districts are really tight. And whether we get another grant or not, we are very connected and committed to following this through from the workforce end of it to, you know, wherever it goes.
We have applied for another grant, and I really hope you're on the review committee.
So I represent West Virginia, so I have total Appalachia, you know,
yes,
spirit with you all, and I applaud what you're doing. And we're experimenting with bringing workforce environments to, like, redesigning school around workplace environments. And we'll say, Mr. Justice, you had commented about, you know, it's tough for, if you're not an entrepreneur, to be like, you know, trying to embody entrepreneurship with kids, right? Lots of teachers have part, they're like hugely, hugely committed to kids, but they may not be entrepreneurs. And there's something to it, like being real. And kids see through it when you're not real. And so what we're finding is the teachers are saying to us, these middle school teachers are like, look, we don't know workplaces. We know our workplace, it's a school. And if we're lucky, we get teachers that have had other sort of dynamic, you know, career moves in their lives, like they've done the circus thing. And so they're like, we want to go out, we need to explore, and we need to immerse ourselves in workplace environments so that we can bring those practices back. Because it's like, it's tough.
That's why you have to have the multi-stakeholder approach.
Yeah.
And mentorships and internships are really important. We've started through our work. We have a really active workforce development group in our region, and so we've developed this we call it the One Up internship, and so we run high school and college kids through there, and that's been, you know, it's just starting to get impact, but it's actually at BitSource, we just hired our first intern. So, you know, it was a 6-month internship, and then we turned into a job for him. But he was a, you know, college age kid, but we also put high school kids through these things. So, but they need that. They need that real world experience and to interface and learn in the workplace, because I'm older than everyone here. When I was growing up, that's how you learned. But now with all the rules and regulations and liability and all that, you can't go. But, you know, I learned my skill sets doing alongside adults. And I worked from the time I was in eighth grade, I was somewhere doing something. And we don't do that as much anymore. We have structured playtime for our kids, and my daughter the same. And you lose something. And so internships is probably a way maybe to counter that.
And I know that we just hit our time, and I wanted to say thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it. And again, I would love to learn a little bit more about you from West Virginia. I'm from West Virginia, and I'm working with rural schools in Pennsylvania building the same model, and we wanted to eventually connect Appalachia and go connect the schools in Kentucky with West Virginia and then work in the rural schools in Pennsylvania. So if you have time to talk after, that'd be great. Thank you all very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.